This week in Retronauts, Choa Nikki is watching you. That's funny, you see, because Choa Nikki means big brother.
Oh, my God.
There we go.
I knew Aniki is brother. What's Cho?
Great. Super.
Okay.
Big.
Superlative.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, hi, everyone. Welcome to an episode of – a very obscure episode of Retronauts, I think, maybe. I mean, we've certainly started off on that footing.
We've already proved we only know Japanese through what we've seen in anime, I think.
Right.
At least
or
I
video
do.
Games.
Or video games, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Choa Nikki, the scene in Final Fantasy VII with the Honeybee Manor and the muscle dudes, like that was kind of riffing on that whole concept of like
the
big bro.
The like, well, I guess we can get into it later, but the kind of reverse of American stereotype of gay men, you know, instead of being like wispy and thin and limp-wristed or whatever, instead they're all giant bodybuilders. In Japan.
Yeah.
I'm not saying either stereotype is good. I'm just saying they're different.
Right. So, sorry. That's kind of a weird preamble to this episode. But we are getting into some undiscovered or unexplored territory for us, I think. And we'll be talking about really big muscle dudes all episode long. So, hello. I'm Jeremy Parrish. Not a big muscular dude. I'm neither tall nor muscular. So, I have no business being here. But maybe you guys can help me out from my straight ahead, from my noon, my 12 o'clock.
Hello. This is Bob Mackey. And we finally have a president with the balls to reference bad dudes.
Oh, yeah.
He's said bad dudes before, and he'll say it again.
And that is one president that the bad dudes do not want to rescue.
Thank you, ninjas.
I think the bad dudes would fight him in a video game. He'd be the last boss.
He would make them buy a well-cooked aged steak, a well-done aged steak, and eat it with ketchup.
Ugh. I'd rather eat a turkey leg out of a trash can. And I'm a vegetarian.
All right.
I'm used to drinking sodas that I find behind barrels. I'm Steve Lin from the Video Game History Foundation.
Oh, yes. And congratulations on the launch of that.
Thank you
it's
very much.
It's very exciting.
Yeah,
we need
to
work together and stuff because we're complementary purposes, I think.
Yeah. In fact, we announced it on this show.
That's true. You did. Yeah. And
wait a minute, where's our cut, Steve?
Of that nonprofit money.
I know you're making money.
Nonprofit
you're rolling
cash.
In it.
And we did invite Frank Cifaldi for this episode, but I haven't heard from him, so I guess he's not going to be here, which is a shame because I really feel like this is an episode topic that he would have a lot to say about. Not because Frank is necessarily interested in, you know, beefy muscle men in video games, but because I remember a long time ago back at 1UP, he was talking about something called that he called guy games, and it kind of dovetails with this topic.
I like to think that he every day is perfecting his Bioforce Ape speedrun. He got too wrapped up in come to Retronauts.
Yeah, so the idea behind guy games is just like games about a dude who kills stuff. And specifically in that kind of late NES era vibe, you really saw a lot of like the 8-bit platformers like Vice Project Doom and Shatterhand. And that definitely intersects with what we're talking about here today, which I'm calling this episode Brototypes. The idea being that it's sort of the developmental prototype phase of the bro-centric dude games that we see today. You know, when you have men who are made of basically carved from tree trunks, like in Gears of War, where did that come from? I think part of the answer is, you know, 90s Image Comics. But also I think there was a lot of development in this kind of aesthetic and mindset, like video games should be empowering and you should be a big, powerful dude that took place throughout the 80s especially. And interestingly, mostly you saw it in Japanese games. You don't really think of like big, beefy, show-off musculature and Japanese games together. But that's really – I kind of feel like that's where all of this sort of fomented and came into shape. So we're going to talk about this, and I don't know what conclusions we'll come to. If nothing else, maybe we'll all just want to go back and play some more Vice Project Doom. But I don't know. I feel like there are some interesting things to be said about this. So hopefully I'm not mistaken, and I'm, you know, kind of jumping into a sort of oblique topic, and we'll come up with something interesting. So it's on you guys. your body is ready.
Yes, with my skinny muscular, arms and legs.
Muscular body.
When you said guy game, I thought we were talking about the recall.
The guy game?
PS2. Duh. Yeah, trivia game, right?
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they went on the attack against us at 1UP because Nick Maragos gave them a really rotten review, which was well-deserved.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an early take on the like Dennis Dyack Twitter attack approach.
Were
Twitter didn't exist back there.
So how could a debate even happen?
I know, right?
Jeez, come on, guys. Get it together.
All right. So we're going to set the Wayback Machine for the early 1980s. And basically, to this point, you had video games tended to be very abstract. Like if you look at video games in the 70s, it's pretty much stick figures or like the loosest outlines of things. And then, you know, in the early 80s, arcade hardware started to develop and become capable of showing more, you know, bigger sprites, more colors, more sprites, more detailed backgrounds. And then consoles followed suit and computers as well. You know, compare, you know, the earliest, like the VIC-20 or PET versus the C64 or the NES. And, you know, there's this kind of evolutionary leap in capabilities of what these systems are capable of demonstrating. And as a result, you started to see developers explore more diverse and unique and specific styles. I don't know. Did you guys – right, Steve, you're probably old enough to, like me, kind of remember when video games went from being – just sketchy, loose stick figures to something more figurative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, for instance, Atari box art, right, where you saw kind of the painterly things and like, oh, okay, it's very abstract, right, when you're, looking, and you're actually playing the game. But then as you started seeing actual characters with limbs and then sort of definition in terms of, oh, that person's wearing a different shirt. And as you mentioned, like especially arcade hardware at the time, it was progressing pretty quickly, so you would see games released in the same year that look like they're from different decades, mm-hmm. right? Just because someone had come up with a way of providing more fidelity. So, I definitely, you know, I think for me, one of those moments was when you saw the size of characters in like Punch-Out.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And it's like, whoa.
Like the arcade Punch-Out?
Sorry, the arcade Punch-Out.
No, I mean, that's fine. Both NES and arcade Punch-Out were pretty remarkable achievements on their respective platforms, but arcade Punch-Out really was just like, how are
glorious.
These gigantic people capable of being on the screen?
Right. Yeah. And I think, you could see personality in characters, I think. They started to have their own little quirks and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think those were the sort of the things I noticed as we're approaching the era we're talking about here.
Yeah. I mean, you look back in the 70s and you had Pong and then Space Invaders, where you can kind of see like there is a design aesthetic at work. Mm-hmm. All the alien invaders resemble seafood, you know, sea animals, basically crustaceans, shrimp and crab and squid. And you know, you around the same time had something like Death Race 2000, where you're the vaguest suggestion of a car running over stick figures.
Uh-huh, right. Yeah.
But then 1980, you have Pac-Man, you have Rally X, where, you know, Pac-Man, there wasn't a lot of detail, but it was good design. They managed to take a yellow circle and personify it, which, you know, that takes some doing. Yep. But it's
that,
you know,
circle fell in love.
But right. Well, you know, part of it is I can't remember, there's an actual term for it, and I can't remember what it is, but the human desire to see themselves in things, which is why you like that entire Om Nom Nom phenomenon.
Like the power outlet right there.
Yeah,
it's a face.
It's a face.
It's a screaming
face. Two things and another thing, and so that's eyes and a mouth. So we looked at a circle that had a moving wedge and missing from it, and that became a person with a mouth. But as games began to develop technically, we didn't have to imagine the mouth. We didn't have to imagine it was a person, you know. The same company, like the following year, made Dig Dug, where you had a little squat dude, and he actually did have, you know, human proportions, kind of very, very lumpy proportions, but there was a face, there were arms and legs and a torso.
Eyes.
Did he become ripped when he became Mr. Driller's dad?
No, I mean, Namco never took that franchise in that direction. It was always very cute. I mean, he was Mr. Driller's dad, and Mr. Driller was very much a very cute-looking series.
He was cute.
All along, very stylistic, very lanky.
We haven't read my Dig Dug fan fiction.
Please upload your deviant art.
It's on the inflation fetish forums.
Right.
Oh, boy. And Vore.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, so yeah, like I think, you know, in Japan especially, you really saw game designers and developers, graphic artists starting to look to cartoons and to manga and anime and the very efficient approach that those mediums have when it comes to representing humans. Mm. I mean, manga was basically defined by Osamu Tezuka, a very, very prolific artist who, you know, he was like Jack Kirby times five. I mean, it's amazing the amount of output that guy created.
Yeah.
Just sheer tons and tons of illustrations and animations every day.
And
it's in large part because he developed this very efficient style inspired by Disney that was extremely minimal. Like he could, define a character by just a few elements like their hairstyle, their eyes, the shape of their face, you know, their body, maybe like some kind of weird deformity like a giant nose with pimples on it or something. But it was extremely loose, extremely sketchy, and it created this economy of visual language that really took root in manga. And that translated very nicely over to video games, you know, the games that Japanese developers were making in the early 80s.
I think the abstraction is important, but the anime angle is just looking at anime cheaply made at the time, how little they had to move on the screen to imply movement. You would see that in a lot of NES games and cutscenes, just like a character is bobbing up and down and there are just lines coming at him. So they were able to take those techniques, those very very cheap, affordable, and easy to do techniques and like apply them to games as well, I think.
Right. And so, you know, I remember from being in the – being in arcades during the golden era, which let's say was 1980 through 83, 84, video games were almost universally cute, or else they were kind of, you know, like abstract technological, you know, vehicles like Moon Patrol or something where you have a vehicle and it's not super cute. It's just sort of detailed.
Your spaceship or something, right?
Yeah. But if you had human characters or, you know, cartoon animals on screen, they were extremely cute. And so that was really the look of arcade games, and you know that bled into console games and computer games at the same time. But what we're going to look at this episode is what kind of evolved out of that sort of toward the middle of the 80s. And I don't know exactly where the demarcation might be, but it's this new trend in visual design for video games. And again, mostly on Japan's side, there was some of it in the US and the UK, which we'll talk about. But it's almost like this this strange mutation of Japanese art aesthetics just sort of came out of nowhere, and suddenly video games started to be very cute, or else very, very violent and very butch and extremely graphic. And there was a huge obsession among a lot of these games with sort of hyper-muscular characters. And yeah, I'd like to talk about kind of where that came from and talk about some of the notable examples of this style, you know, up through the early 90s, and talk about some of the results that came from this. You know, what's the legacy of these bodybuilder video games? So to begin with, what would you guys kind of peg, you know, if you were to just take a blind stab at it as the sort of move away from cute and cartoonish in game aesthetics to muscular and angry and, you know, gory and so on and so forth? I mean, that maybe hit its peak in the 90s with stuff like Thrill Kill, which we talked about in the last episode we recorded. But certainly that mindset was around long before that.
I would say just for me growing up, maybe Golden Axe. I mean, other games predated it, but it was clearly – I mean, we can trace a lot of these back to American movies, as you point out in your notes, Jeremy. But that was clearly like, oh, we saw Conan the Barbarian or Conan the Destroyer. We want to make that our game. And they did. And that was kind of when I took note of it in terms of, you know, just these muscular characters committing acts of violence. That was sort of the first time I took note, I think.
Yeah, I think for me it was, you know, as the hardware progressed, it gave a lot more creative freedom. Mm-hmm. So people could start experimenting with things that were, for lack of a term, more violent or, you know, had more definition in the characters. I think for me, one of them was Ikari Warriors. I think was a big game for me. Because, you know, again, that the weird top-down view, you know, big muscular. It was basically two Rambos on the screen at the same time.
I don't know about you, Steve, but growing up, a lot of people called that Atari Warriors just because Atari was another video game thing. And that was always very confusing. It's like, no, it's Ikari. That's a Japanese word that I don't know what it means. But
it's Shinji's name.
That's right, yeah.
But Ikari Warriors is not about Shinji and his father.
No, that would be
Maybe it is, right? You can't tell ages from the top down, right?
So. Well, I did a Photoshop of that once with like the box art for those characters, but then Shinji and Gendo's faces superimposed.
If anyone would have done that, it would have been you.
It was me.
Right. Yeah, I think that one and then something we'll get into later, but I think Operation Wolf was a big one just because it was sort of environmental in that you had that Uzi that sort of shook, and then the close up to the guys, it felt like you were actually in a Rambo movie, right? It was probably the closest thing that I could think of at the time.
Yeah, for me, I think probably the first time I really like stopped and said, "Huh, that's like you know, like Conan right there in a video game form," was Black Tiger by Capcom.
Oh, you know what? I played that before Golden Axe. Mm-hmm. So no, you're right.
And if I'm not mistaken, I didn't think to look this one up, but I believe like the promotional art for that was actually just like totally just straight ripped off from Frank Frazetta. And that's one of the inspirations for this style, I think, that we should talk about is Frank Frazetta and his fantasy art. But like Black Tiger, I'm sure you guys remember it. You're like a dude in a loincloth and you've got sort of like a chain flail. So it's kind of a Castlevania sort of thing, but it moves a lot faster than Castlevania and is not nearly as fair as Castlevania. It doesn't have that very deliberate design that Castlevania has. It's much more like arcade quarter muncher where things hit you and it's not fair.
Right.
But, you know, as you power up, then your flail becomes longer and then it starts to like shoot beams or daggers or something. And then the flail flies out in like multiple directions and you're shooting daggers in multiple directions. So you get really powered up. It's kind of like it's almost like a PC Engine shoot 'em up, except you're a dude with a chain flail instead of a spaceship flying around in space, but the same sort of progressive power and mechanics. And it really does feel like, you know, a D&D module paint, like box painting come to life.
Was there a sequel? I might have played more of the sequel.
There wasn't, but Magic Tower
was very much
in the same vibe.
Whichever one it is, where you rescue a character and they're your partner.
Yeah,
I like that one a lot.
Yeah, that was. It was not an explicit sequel to Black Tiger, but it's very very much in that same vein. And
I played more of that, but I played Black Tiger a lot too.
Yeah, I love those games, and it's weird because like the idea of super, you know, muscular dudes in Speedos. Like, that's not my aesthetic. I like cute stuff. But sometimes these games, you know, even though I'm kind of like, I don't care about this dude, who cares? Like, the games are still fun enough that it doesn't really matter. It's just another, you know, another ridiculous, unrealistic character that you're controlling. And it doesn't make a difference if it's, you know, Taizo Hori, the little chubby Dig Dug guy, or the Black Tiger guy.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point to bring up. You know, at the time, I don't think I ever didn't play a game because of its aesthetic, right? Does this look like a fun game or not? And so it wasn't like I was looking for, I want the big muscular dude or that one's too cute or curly or whatever for me to try out. It was a lot of stuff was coming out. You want to see what's a fun game and just, you know, play it. So
yeah, I don't think this really became sort of an undercurrent until a little later. But yeah, like, you know, just the sort of primal fantasy type stuff doesn't really do much for me. And I don't tend to really care that much about a lot of genres, honestly, but they all tend to be sort of like super masculine. I'm like, that's tired. That's played out. But, you know, good game design is good game design. So a lot of these games, you know, even though I look at the box art and I'm like, oh, it's big muscle guys again. Who cares?
I think I think we finally have hit the end of the era of revenge dad games where you are a dad getting revenge for some reason. It was like 2009 to 2012 or 2013. It's like every game was about a dad and he was like getting revenge about something. A kid was taken or something or other. But
the Liam Neeson influence.
Exactly. It was a short-lived fad I did not care for.
you know, I think to kind of lay the groundwork for this, you have to go back to the 70s, really, because there are a lot of cultural trends that began to take hold in the 60s and especially the 70s. A lot of them here in the U.S., even though we're talking about mostly games from Japan, we, you know, in those era, those days especially, exported so much popular culture, and Japan was so kind of, I would say, collectively hungry to absorb the media that we exported, that I think it had a profound impact. I mean, all you have to do is look at stuff, something like, you know, the Daikon 4 animation that Gainax did back before they became a studio. And that's just full of there's like Japanese pop culture stuff, but there's also, you know, all kinds of references to Star Wars and other, you know, American media, superheroes and that sort of thing.
I love how much it does. It's like, we don't care. We'll draw this thing because we like it. It was not meant for to be sold in any case, but I just love how they're embracing all the things they love in those videos.
Yeah. Or then you have, you know, Revenge of Shinobi, which has – it has Godzilla as a boss, but it also has Batman and Spider-Man. And whoops, we can't really actually do that. We didn't pay for these guys, so they had to be changed in the Genesis version when it came to the U.S.
Right. Well, you look at box art, right? You know, the cover of Metal Gear is Michael Biehn. Mm-hmm. Right.
And, oh yeah, the tracing was the tracing was strong with Konami, especially in those days. But a lot of there's a great feature on Hardcore Gaming 101. You'll have to look through their archives, but it shows like pilfered box art through the ages, and it's a lengthy feature. It's a two-parter actually.
That was
very much a thing that was common back then.
You've listed some of these here, but I kind of believe the DNA of every video game can be found in five movies. The Warriors, Conan the Barbarian, Evil Dead, Terminator, and Rambo 2, I think.
Star Wars? Are you talking about specifically these games?
Star Wars maybe, but I think we did an episode about Star Wars and we really couldn't see a lot of influence in stuff when we were, when we were going on about that. It had less influence than we thought it would.
That is true.
Yeah. But I mean, it still influenced people. But I think those five movies.
Did you say Aliens? You didn't say Aliens.
Aliens. Okay, six movies. Aliens is important too. But yeah, it could be six, it could be 10 movies. But like that period influenced Japan, who was at the top of their game at the time, who made all the best games. Mm-hmm. And that influenced what would be made after that. So I feel like drawing back to those movies is where like the roots of modern game concepts come from still.
Yeah. But, you know, even going back before those movies, almost all of them are from the 80s, the Warriors.
Yeah. It's 79, might as well be 80.
You do have these cultural trends that I was mentioning, and one of them was the rise of bodybuilding. I mean, you know, going back to like the 50s or so, you still had guys like Charles Atlas, but bodybuilding became this thing in the 70s. It became extremely popular, and you started to really see it reflected in fantasy art. I mentioned Frank Frazetta. There was also Boris Vallejo or Vallejo. I don't know how you pronounce his name.
Like Barbarella and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, Sean Connery as Zardoz.
Oh, God. No, I don't want to even picture that.
Scene that's already there.
But, just like I think probably Conan is probably the big inflection point for a lot of
this. Oh, for sure, yeah.
But, I mean, Conan and Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of rose at the same time. Arnold Schwarzenegger was like the iconic Mr. Universe because of the just sheer definition that he enforced upon his body. He was a huge guy already, and he made himself extremely muscular and the muscles extremely well-defined, as opposed to being kind of what you saw before that, where people would be muscular but also tended to have kind of like the football linebacker look, where they were sort of doughy outside the hard muscle core.
I mean, we have muscular leading men now, like who plays Captain America?
Chris Evans.
Yeah, I mean, he's a buff guy, but in this era, it was like they're always shirtless and bronze and oily. Like, well, you always saw them in bodybuilder style, like, I guess, poses and oilings and
the new muscular
oilings. I don't know. It's a word.
The new muscular in Hollywood is very lean muscle.
Yeah,
whereas
that's true.
In the '70s,
like
it was
bulging.
Extremely. Yeah, just like check out my quadriceps. My biceps have triceps.
I've created new muscles.
Yeah, basically.
Well, if you look at it, I mean, also at this time, things like professional wrestling, right?
Oh, yeah,
WWE
for sure.
And sort of Vince McMahon.
That was a little later. That was the 80s.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it was before the 70s. I'm just seeing like how they kind of hit.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Hulk Hogan when I think of an orange oily man who's very buff in an unnatural way.
Yeah, in the 70s, like I said, you had Conan really kind of come into popularity through comic books. And honestly, up before that, if you looked at comic book characters, the Superman-type characters tended to be strong. Like, they definitely had muscle definition, but they weren't huge. Like, you had, you know, John Byrne-style artwork where everyone has well-defined bodies. Like, they're very lean. But you tended not to see super hulking characters unless it was a character like the Hulk or Colossus whose entire gimmick was this dude hits really hard. Mm-hmm. And that began to change, you know, in the 70s and into the 80s thanks to the rise of bodybuilding. Something I can't really speak to myself, mm-hmm. but I think does tie into this is the sort of mainstreaming of the gay community throughout the 60s and the 70s mm-hmm. and the sort of, you know, the idea that, hey, the male gaze can actually be at males. It doesn't just have to be looking at women's boobs. It can be looking at really, really well-defined men as well.
It could be part of the power fantasy that serves the male interest too, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's the power fantasy, but mm-hmm. I do think that, you know, as mainstream America became more sympathetic to the gay community, and I, you know, I, like I said, I don't want to assume too much here because it's outside my personal realm of experience, and I don't want to be insulting to anyone or make assumptions. But you definitely did see, you know, a lot of popular singers who people began to realize, like, oh, Freddie Mercury, Queen, like. There's a reason the band is called Queen. In the 80s, you had the entire AIDS crisis where all of a sudden, you know, the gay community became extremely sympathetic because of what was happening to them.
Yeah, notable celebrities were dying, not just people no one knew about.
Right. So I really do think that this had an impact in kind of, you know, popular culture and the things began, you know, the way people were presented, the way, you know, art looked. I think there was always, you know, in the creative community, a lot of closeted people who couldn't necessarily express themselves in their lifestyles, but maybe in their artwork, you began to kind of see things that you look back at and say, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, I don't know how much that impact that had, but there's just all these things sort of building at the same time. And again, you had, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and you had fantasy novels and that sort of thing. So I think those all sort of convened and converged in the early 80s. And right about that time, video games began to operate on systems, on a hardware that was capable of rendered humans. Like very well, you know, defined people. And so, of course, you know, video games frequently had an element of violence to them. So it makes sense to have a big guy who can inflict a lot of hurt running around with an axe. And if he's going to be wielding an axe, then he's probably got to be big and strong to carry, you know, this giant axe. So that is my thought on where a lot of these influences came from. I think I'm missing stuff. Would anyone like to kind of counterpropose anything? I don't want this to be just me.
It does seem
pulling
like,
stuff out of my ass.
The perfect storm of elements to cause these games to be made. I can't think of anything else that you could be missing or could be wrong about.
All right. Well, I think one of the things you brought up about gay culture was just how it had changed over, you know, the 60s and 70s where you see things like Easy Rider or, you know, Marlon Brando, like the leather jacket, T-shirt. Like there was a sense of, I guess, machismo that started to become more prevalent. And so you were seeing a wider range of kind of like the perception of homosexuality. And it's like, oh, you know, like you're saying big buff guys and then you have kind of the sort of stereotypical stuff that you would see in the 70s. It's like there's a wide range here and, you know, people kind of pushing where they went in terms of dress and everything else that you're like, oh, you can see influences, you know, especially in like, for lack of a better, like bosses, right? In video games, right? Like kind of that over the top. Like this is someone who's just got all kinds of cool stuff on.
Yeah, right? Especially like men in S&M gear and things like that, and like Final Fight things. Yeah, I mean, just like these sort of things are just made part of pop culture.
Like leather and studs and a lot of that, right?
Yeah, and I think it's important to know that there have always been gay game creators. There have always been transgender gay game creators. That LGBT culture has always been within video games. And so obviously some of that's going to come out and be expressed in the games. And I think, the popular trends were they made that possible in a lot of ways. You know, the rise of Conan the Barbarian as, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger as Conan and, just the entire like oily dude in a loincloth fantasy genre that emerged in kind of those low budget movies that you see on Mystery Science Theater a lot.
Like Beastmaster?
Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. Mark Singer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I said, everything was kind of coming to together, converging, and around 1985 or so, video games kind of began to take a step forward in terms of design, going from like the single screen arcade game to more expansive worlds where you could have bigger characters. I mean, in the single screen games, you had to have kind of tiny characters, so there was enough space and enough, you know, room for the character to move around in. But once Super Mario Brothers and Ghosts and Goblins came out, all of a sudden, you know, these games were moving forward and the world didn't consist of a single screen. So your characters could be larger and they could have better definition. They could have more detail to them. Mm-hmm. And Ghosts and Goblins, you know, almost works in this, except it's so cartoonish. It's got that Tokuro Fujiwara art style. Like his characters always have this kind of like goofy sort of very primitive and lanky, almost like something out of Mad Magazine or something. But, you know, Arthur, he takes a hit and he's reduced down to his boxer shorts.
Yeah, right.
So he's like a dude running around in boxers. And that's pretty much like Rastan Saga and, you know, Castlevania, like a dude running around in a loincloth.
But the gargoyles and bosses are pretty ripped in that game, right? They've got abs.
Yeah. Devil's got abs, doesn't he?
Devil's got some
red,
big abs.
No, in the first one, the red armors, the red devils don't really have that much like bodily definition, but yeah,
I could be thinking of the sequel.
Get into the 16-bit games, and all of a sudden you've got big beefy dudes,
the muscular devil naked sitting in a chair that you're fighting as the final boss. That's it. Yeah,
exactly. So you had, you know, technology moving forward, game design moving forward, and I think one final really important keystone moment here was the game Karateka by Jordan Mechner, which it wasn't, you know, muscular men, but it was extremely realistic in terms of its presentation. The animation was rotoscoped and very, very convincing. Like it moved very fluidly, and it was very closely based on another one of these sort of formative influences, you know, like Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon, the sort of Chambara fighting style movies. The idea of just like a pure physical test of endurance and strength. So even though Karateka did not have that sort of protein powder vibe to it, it still was very much in the like the proto brawler era. Maybe another good kind of inflection point the same year, 1984, would be Kung Fu or Kung Fu Master or Spartan X or whatever you want to call it, which was actually based on a Jackie Chan movie.
Right.
And it was also kind of cartoonish, but it still had that sort of, you know, one guy taking on a whole bunch of dudes and kind of overcoming impossible odds with just his fists and feet.
A lot of grunting and screaming in that game too.
Yeah.
People grabbing onto you.
Yeah.
Well, when I first saw Karateka, I think that was definitely a game where I – like, what is that? That really – it looks it's so fluid, right, that it really feels like – you know, we're getting closer to realism in games, even though when you look at it now, it does look pretty primitive.
Yeah. I mean, I saw Prince of Persia first, but I have the same opinion. Nothing looked like it even then.
Right. I mean, we might get to this later, but when you played like Rastan, right, there was sort of an animation, like a weight to the sword as he swung it. And, you know, that was basically Conan the game, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So. Yeah, the sound and everything, it just really kind of pulled you in.
So not to overemphasize the importance of Nintendo here, but I do think it is notable that both Kung Fu Master or Spartan X or whatever you want to call it and Karateka made it to Famicom in 1985.
Right.
And basically 1986 is where you start to see this this new aesthetic in games really take off in Japanese arcade and console games. Mm-hmm. So I really feel like those two games, you know, kind of opened the floodgates.
And they were both really successful, right?
Yeah, yeah. Wow,
so
Crotica was a pretty big deal in Japan. We didn't get it here on any consoles, but it showed up on a bunch of systems, including Game Boy, several years later. So it was a pretty big hit, and you know, it was arrived right at the time that the Famicom was really making it big in Japan, and every game that came out kind of became a hit, became something that people were aware of. So I think that's a pretty important thing to make note of.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, random aside, the box for Karateka on Famicom is amazing because of that From USA graphic that's in the upper right-hand corner. It's sort of like North America-ish.
So you know it's good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was trying to advertise.
So I kind of broke down the games we're talking about into a few different categories. The Conan games, the Commando and Predator games. Both of these are Schwarzenegger. And then just kind of other Hollywood influences. And then look beyond that to more homegrown Japanese concepts, you know, seinen manga, manga for men, basically, and anime. So, I mean, I think obviously the most sensible place to start here would be to look at the Conan games, the Conan-inspired games. I don't think there was ever actually a Conan game until a few years back with Funcom's MMO, was there?
Not that I think of it. There was probably maybe like a licensed PC or
There might have been a game based on the 90s cartoon Conan the Adventurer. I'm not sure though. There might have been a bad game based on that.
Right. Actually, well, nothing memorable for sure.
Right.
Right.
I mean, actually, now that I think about it, maybe there was one for NES that I'm just totally forgetting.
It's possible.
One of those Western developed games that I'm like no one really cares about.
Right.
Let's have a quick look.
Someone's screaming at their podcast machine right now.
Yeah, right.
It's like, how could you forget that game?
Oh, there was a Conan game for NES. So how about that? Let's have a look and see what it's like. Yeah. Oh, and C64, Apple II, PS2.
Fact-checking ruined.
Conan, the Mysteries of Time.
Okay, so I'm mistaken. There was a Conan game for NES, but not really that impressive looking. Conan's a little guy.
It's called The Mysteries of
Time. Look how tiny he is.
It's by Mindscape, makers of Help Me Out Here. What did they do? Somebody's got to know this.
Mindscape was a publisher. They didn't really make stuff.
Oh, yeah. So. Well, this says it was developed by Mindscape.
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
It could be wrong, though.
All right. So there were Conan video games, but none of them had any real impact on culture, whereas Conan-inspired games were a big deal. And I don't know the exact chronology on these, but I kind of feel like the first really big one was Razdan Saga, where, you know, you were talking about that earlier, where it's just like a dude with a big, you know, double-handed broadsword, and there is this remarkable sense of weight to your actions. Mm-hmm. Like you swing the sword and it feels like you're really committing to it. And Razdan showed up – that was a Sega game, right?
Yeah.
That was
arcade.
Yeah, that was on a bunch of Sega systems. And I don't know. Like I've never quite gotten into Razdan Saga, and I think it is because of that weight to it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it slows the game action down too much, and it's not as responsive as I would like. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You seem to have a fondness for it.
Yeah, I really liked it. Quite frankly, one of the big things for me was the music. I love the music in that game, especially the arcade version. And then maybe there was something because you had to be more deliberate. You couldn't just kind of keep like spamming the sword button.
Right.
There was a sense of like distance between everything, and then the characters that would show up. Right. They had, you know, the lion breathing fire and the flying things, and you can get the I think it's like an axe that gave you more range. It just something about that game really. I loved playing it in the arcade. So
yeah, it kind of reminds me of Namco's Dragon Buster, which is kind of showed up on the other side of the divide. I feel like if Dragon Buster had come out a few years later, it probably would have looked more like one of these games. But it was still in the sort of cartoon era. So you have this very cartoonish looking guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the controls are very stiff. But there is almost this sense of like, hey, you're kind of in this primal fantasy world. Go explore things and kill stuff. And you can't actually really explore that much. But there's just something about the way the world is presented where it does feel like you're this sort of lone wanderer who is, you know, badly overmatched by all kinds of crazy demons and monsters and stuff and has to fight his way through.
Well, even the death animation is – he is sort of him like falling backwards and dissolving. So there was – you know, once again, this is part of technology, right, providing more depth to the game.
Right.
And then there are some alternative paths, but they're really simplistic right. in the game. So.
Well, I mean, that death animation is that right there is a counterpoint to Sega's usual vibe, which was your cartoon character would fall over dead and the little angel would fly up. All kinds Alex of Sega, kid, yeah. Sega games always did that. They always had the little guy, his little angel fly up. Wonder Boy also.
Oh, yeah, Wonder Boy. Yeah.
Yeah, for me, the game that kind of did Rastan right was Rygar.
I played a bit more of that.
Although I'm not a fan of the arcade game.
Because I don't like it either.
It's like Rastan, but worse. Whereas the NES game is actually really kind of remarkable. It was very ambitious. They took this game and said, oh, there's kind of this sense of, you know, you're roaming a world and fighting through monsters while trying to explore and find your way around. What if you actually did have to explore? What if you actually had to, you know, instead of just going through 40 levels from left to right, what if you actually had to kind of find your way around this big hub world and discover items and learn magic spells and things like that? And so it became sort of this early, almost like proto-Metroidvania game. So of course I like it. But it also felt really fluid and interesting. You had really good control over – I don't think his name was Rygar. I think Rygar was supposed to be Ligar, the demon like lion slash tiger thing at the end that you have to fight. I think he was just like the warrior of Argos. I could be mistaken about that. But you had really good control over him. Like there was some aerial maneuverability. You jump forward and he kind of – you could pull him back and make very precise jumps. But his weapon was really great. It was this – it was called the disc armor. It was basically like a shield. It was kind of Captain America-ish. But imagine Captain America with like a very short tether on a shield, like a yo-yo almost. So to attack enemies, you would fling this circular thing forward, and it flew out really quickly and respond or like returned really quickly. So it didn't have the sort of delay and wind up that Rastan's weapon did. You just toss this disc armor at enemies, and as you advance through the game, you could get a longer chain for it and more power for it. So it was very much in a sort of Castlevania vibe, which I think Castlevania also sort of falls – like maybe it's – I would say like almost a golden trio of these sort of formative barbarian games, Rastan, Rygar, and Castlevania. And Castlevania had the most deliberate action, but unlike Rastan, the world was really designed – I've talked about this a lot – about how the world of Castlevania is designed around Simon Belmont's limitations, how high he can jump, how long it takes him to wind up and swing his whip. You know, the movements of the enemies are crafted in just such a way to be very, very challenging but not impossible. If you know where they're coming from, if you understand how they move, you can predict them and you can respond to them. So you have to be careful, you know, not to overcommit to your actions. You have to be very deliberate. But it's very exciting. And that's another one of those where the cover art is just totally ripped off of, I think, a Frazetta painting. You know, Simon Belmont. It's a very famous box art. You know,
I love it.
Yeah. Like you see Dracula's face superimposed over the sky, but there's, you know, the real thing is the castle in the distance, and Simon's standing there with his back to the camera, to the viewer, wielding his whip, which kind of like coils around in air as he's about to lash forward with it.
Was that identical in Japan, the box art? I was just curious if that was a Japanese artist.
That is the Japanese art.
Okay, interesting.
Castlevania and Castlevania 2 have the same box art.
Yeah.
Both territories. Castlevania 3 does not, and the U.S. box art is much, much better. It's got a really nice, very dynamic-looking painting of Trevor Belmont and his like companions kind of at an angle with like a dragon breathing fire at him. Whereas in Japan, like the characters are painted really badly and Trevor, or actually Ralph in Japan, looks like Luke Wilson. It's really weird.
I don't think I've seen a version of the Castlevania 3 US box art without the Win a Trip to Transylvania.
I don't think it exists.
A pop out thingy.
Yeah.
Is that, that's not a sticker. It's
no,
part
it
of the
part
art.
Of the box art.
Man, bummer.
Yep. Yeah. I don't think they reprinted it. So you never got that.
That art's
got
to be somewhere. I hope it's not thrown away.
Konami, I'm sure Konami has it in their archives.
They care about their game
it.
So much.
So, you know, as I feel like these three games really kind of define that look, and they all had a lot of clones. I mean, Black Tiger, I would consider a Rastan clone. Castlevania had clones like Eight Eyes, which we've mentioned on Retronauts before. Mm. You did start to see some different ideas. One of the – probably the biggest one was Altered Beast, where it was basically – much more straightforward, but you had much larger characters, just these huge dudes who were totally bodybuilders. They had like these tiny microcephalic heads. And as you collected power-ups, you could transform into like super muscle men monsters.
Yeah, like everything in this game just had abs in it.
Yeah,
like,
it was like
they were totally shredded.
It was right. It was bodybuilders of the video game.
Made by the Sonic team, basically,
yep.
Too.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Yeah, and It kind of is sort of a definitive game in this style because it's so sluggish and clunky. Like you think a dude who has just been working on his reps and building up muscle mass is going to be a little bit stiff and clumsy because
yeah.
He doesn't have much agility. And this game really gets to that. It's like, yeah, these dudes, they're really slow.
But when you punch things, they explode into symmetrical pieces.
They do.
Yeah.
And it's actually very satisfying in that sense. It's not that good a game, but it is very satisfying.
Yeah.
And that one is just very sort of iconic, I think.
Hmm.
Any other thoughts on any of these? I also put Golden Axe in here, which is an entirely different kind of game in itself. But Bob, I think you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I would eventually see the movies that inspired it much later, but definitely some serious Conan vibes, definitely some Frazetta stuff in there. Just a lot of those influences worked in, but it is the barbarian game with a bit more fantasy to it. There's magic, there's elves, there's touches like that. So for sure, I'm pretty sure like Death Adder is from Conan. Is Death Adder the villain in Golden Axe?
Yes,
I'm pretty sure he's from some sort of Conan thing, like a very direct grab. But yeah, I mean, that was the first time I noticed this and really took notice of these kind of games. And later I would discover the source material, but I discovered the games first.
Yeah. Gladiator on the arcade was a big one for me because of the characters were so big, right? They take up.
Yeah, I think that was part of Altered Beast's appeal too. But yeah, Gladiator was really remarkable.
Yeah, that and you can actually knock off armor on different parts of the body.
Right.
So you could like the leg and the chest armor and anything would just go flying off. You know, you were hitting different parts of the characters. So there was that element of like localized damage and then seeing the person underneath, right, instead of just the armor.
I don't think I've played this game. Yeah. Interesting.
So.
I think it's also important to note that at the same time, you know, you were seeing this like more realistic art style, mm-hmm. but some developers kind of said, well, what if we took this realistic, you know, the sort of game design styles that are rising out of this and make them more in our kind of quirky, charming, cutesy way. So you had stuff like Karnov, which isn't cute, but it's very comical. I mean, Karnov is – he's muscular, but it's like the old school fat guy muscular.
Yeah, lifting triangular weights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like the shirtless Nazi in Raiders of the Lost Ark who gets shredded by the airplane.
I'm amused.
He's a slab of body.
I'm just amused by the very existence of Karnov and how Data East would try to bring him back in some ways. Just like he's such a ridiculous character.
Right, but yeah, they turned him into like a franchise basically.
Yeah.
He shows up in Bad Dudes as the first boss.
Right.
And it plays the Karnov music even.
Yeah. And there's like the weird story where he was a bad man, like a thief or something, and God punished him. And his mission in Karnov is to basically redeem himself.
Yeah, the Japanese version of the game has narration or like, you know, text narration, but there's something to it. In the NES game, you just start, you are Karnov, have fun in Karnov land, but there's more to it in Japan. Thank you.
So moving into the second half of this episode, I would like to change up the format a little
bit.
Bob, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I didn't see it on here. Maybe it is, but it is actually on here. Fist of the North Star, I think, is a big influence on a lot of this
stuff. Yeah, we'll get to the manga stuff in
okay.
a little bit.
But I don't know if Fist of the North Star was influenced by anything Hollywood. I mean, there's Mad Max in there a bit, but
absolutely. I mean, it was...
But I
definitely
I don't know.
Mad Max. Yeah. Mad Max very much. Hmm. And, you know, Enter the Dragon.
Oh, yeah, like, for sure. That guy's Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
As hell.
I mean,
Kenshiro.
Yeah, Kenshiro. Except Bruce Lee never said, Omae wa, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
I can't even remember.
But it's worth watching on Crunchyroll, believe me. It's those are great. It's not. It's
Does it have the English dub?
No, but I love the Japanese. It's so super serious, but it's the silliest shit ever. That show. It's like it's the same plot every time. A guy comes to town, then he explodes at the end of the episode. But it's great. It's fun to watch.
Like the Voltron Road Beast.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm going to change up the format a little and jump to some reader letters or listener mail. I asked for people to share their thoughts on this and. I feel like a lot of people kind of came to the same conclusions that we did. So here's one from Mark Mariano. Schwarzenegger, Stallone, video games take so many of their cues from the movies that it's no wonder the biggest action stars of the 80s would influence action games around the same time. In a way, Contra gave the world the Stallone-Schwarzenegger team-up they wouldn't get into the Expendables films decades later. And it's true. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Konami NES box art, it is literally traced from Predator and Rambo, I think.
Yeah.
So that's another one of those lifts.
What are their names? Lance and Billy? Or
Bill and Lance
Bill
or
and
Mad
Lance,
Dog and Scorpion.
Mad Dog and Scorpion,
I think Mad Dog and Scorpion's in Super Contra.
That was a buddy cop movie.
Contra 3, maybe. Let's see. It's strange then that the NES incarnations of Predator and Rambo were so much tamer than the original games that their stars inspired. Dutch Schaefer and John Rambo spend most of their time jumping around and avoiding jungle creatures. Even so, the media depiction of military force and oiled-up muscles popularized by Schwarzenegger and Stallone worked just as well in video games as it did at the box office. Here's an interesting kind of variant from Callum Johnson regarding Bomberman. I thought it was going to be about Bomberman Act Zero.
Not like some like buff Bomberman. He took off the spacesuit underneath.
Inside, I'm ripped.
Right.
All right. From Nathan Hill, I'm in my 40s now, and I'm trying to remember when gaming got into manly games. I didn't think about gender very much regarding my games. Then again, I was a youngster, so there's that. Even so, looking back at games, I realize now that I recognize now as having gender stereotypes like Donkey Kong, it's hard for me to put them into the same basket as something like Double Dragon, despite the fact that the mission is to rescue the female love interest in both games. Games like Kung Fu Master, Renegade, and Double Dragon help set the standard and are some of the earliest examples of my experience with the manification of games. Of course, Razden, whose developers I'm sure jumped at every telephone ring thinking it was the estate of Robert E. Howard calling, can be thrown in there also. Those lead to Golden Axe and Altered Beast, then to Bad Dudes, and so on. Maybe I'm crazy, but I think the popularity of these games can be tied to the feelings of inadequacy its players were experiencing in their lives. In my case, anyway, I wasn't very popular in school, was picked on, teased, etc. I think these games did something for people like me, allowed us to be the hero, and to do things that were popular on TV shows and movies at the time. We now had the power to beat up our bullies, teach them a lesson, and get to the girl at the end to boot. What a rush that was. And from a cathartic point, kicking the bejesus out of someone as a martial artist feels better than jumping on a mushroom or a dinosaur as Mario. That's an interesting speculation. I actually kind of went the other direction because I was always, not always, but I was picked on as a kid sometimes. I have always kind of shied away from big, brawny heroes because they remind me of the jackasses who picked on me when I was a kid. I'm like, I don't want to be them. Like, there's no appeal for me to become that person. I like, you know, saving the day as the opposite of that person. You know, I pick, like, cute characters or, you know, video games like Volus or whatever, you know, where it's a skinny girl saving the day. Like, that's interesting because it's the opposite of those assholes that I hated so much as a kid.
I was thinking about that lawsuit comment. I feel like with how in love with Hollywood Kojima is, James Cameron, the ultimate ploy would be, hey, I want to work with you, Kojima. And Kojima comes into a room to meet James Cameron. The door shut behind him. He says, take a seat. A curtain opens and there are 30 lawyers. And they says, let's talk about your career. You know, it's based on most of my movies.
So here's one from Alex Androsky. As the gaming industry recovered from the crash of 83, armed with a generational leap in technology, the concepts behind individual games could afford to be less abstract and more representational. This meant developers were free to rely even more on one of their favorite tricks, ripping off popular movies. But the late 80s saw the pop culture zeitgeist transformed by films like Conan the Barbarian, Commando, Rambo, and Predator, and games followed suit. Rygar, as you mentioned, was already wearing the influence of cult classic Crawl on its sleeve, while Contra's influences are so blatant that the box art shows Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone fighting a xenomorph. Gaming was capitalizing on cultural trends the same way Mattel's He-Man and Hasbro's G.I. Joe toy lines did. My personal favorite result of this trend was Hideo Kojima's Metal Gear series. Kojima has never hidden his love for movies, and it's easy to see their influence on his work. A protagonist named after Kurt Russell's character in Escape from New York, a commanding officer who looks exactly like Sean Connery, a setting with enough backtracking and re-exploration that you could arguably consider it Die Hard on an X plot, and stealth gameplay that's inspired by James Bond. And that's barely scratching the surface.
Yeah.
So good observations here.
Yeah, Colonel Campbell is the dude from Rambo, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Troutman.
Colonel Troutman. I totally forgot the name of the actor. Oh, well. Yeah, like the Metal Gear 2, the Japanese art, which was totally changed for its eventual American release on the HD collection.
Was the cover Kyle Reese from Terminator, or is that Metal Gear 1?
Yeah, it's Metal Gear 1. Yeah.
Is it again, just Michael directly Bond? Traced in a very beautiful way, but still just that guy.
Yeah.
Billy Norby says, it's easy to lay everything at the emergence of Schwarzenegger's Conan and Stallone's Rocky and First Blood. Frank Fazzetto was already the biggest fantasy illustrator around by the time John Milius directed Conan in 1982. Bodybuilding and the Mr. Universe competition had its cultural peak in the 70s, Schwarzenegger on the male side and Lisa Leon on the female. A better origin might be the launch of Marvel's Conan the Barbarian comic in 1970. It was an unusual series to be made by Marvel given that it had no relationship to their usual superhero universe. But it was a big hit, building on the underground lo-fi popularity of the Robert E. Howard Frazetta paperbacks and the forest-embracing 70s fascination with Tolkien. The comic was beautifully and lavishly drawn by artists like Barry Windsor Smith and John Buscema. Red Sonja, partially a Marvel creation, and Michael Moorcock's albino fantasy hero Elric of Melniboln, a spiritual predecessor to Alucard, were brought into the comics sometime later. Marvel's Conan was simply one of the best comics of the era with fun, swashbuckling stories and stellar artwork. Aside from the fantasy stuff, it would be a mistake also not to mention the 1970s martial arts boom as well. The insane, shirtless physique of Bruce Lee adorned wall posters all over the world and brought a new athletic physicality to action films. Genre stars like Charles Bronson got more and more ripped toward the end of the decade. Then Dungeons & Dragons is a huge hit in the following years, paving the ground for even more fantasy and bold illustrations. Hmm. And he has a link to Hardcore Gaming 101's Tracing the Influence series, which, Michael Bean as Kyle Reese, Solid Snake, Contra, Narc.
Even Narc.
True Lies. Yeah, it's pretty shameless. I'll definitely link to this in the notes for this episode.
Yeah.
So I'll do one more letter and then we can move on to talk a bit more about this stuff. From Juan Gutierrez. As a 1980s kid, I very much enjoy the manly games from the mid to late 80s. Undoubtedly, it all comes from the influence that the 1980s films had in popular culture around the world in an era where internet didn't exist. Not long ago, I would have said this influence was limited to capitalist countries, but after seeing Chuck Norris versus Communism, it's obvious that the influence also extended to communist countries. There's a marked difference in the kind of action seen in 70s and 80s films, almost a matter of style. Who could forget Arnold Schwarzenegger's famous one-liners from his 1980s movies? The style seems to have more easily permeated the Japanese collective of developers in the 80s and the early 90s. It's certainly still very much in the psyche of Hideo Kojima and Goichi Suda to this day. Some of the arcade games I finally remember are manly games very much influenced by 80s movies. For instance, Altered Beast and Golden Axe, In the case of Altered Beast, the visuals seem to be inspired by the Greek mythology represented in Hollywood films like Clash of the Titans and perhaps Jason and the Argonauts. But the muscular protagonists are very much a product of the 80s and the legacy of Conan. And it's Conan once again who seems to be the main inspiration behind Golden Axe, with perhaps a touch of Red Sonja, something I'm intrigued with because it appears to have been Red Sonja in the comic book, not the film, that inspired Tyrus Flair's appearance. It's what's important to say about these games is that what drew me to them wasn't the gameplay, but the visuals, these manly depictions of fantasy violence that were very cool to me, much like 80s cartoons like Silverhawks, Thundercats, Mask, He-Man, or Defenders of the Earth. Of course, Golden Axe is in fact an improvement on the also manly game Double Dragon that inspired all other manly beat-em-ups.
Hmm. Yeah. On the cartoon front, there was also, what, Thundar the Barbarian?
Is that
Hanna-Barbera?
I think he had a bird. Did he have a bird?
Pet bird? I don't know if he had a pet bird.
But sounds right.
He had Oompa-La, that like orange guy, and then the woman.
And wasn't Thundar the design for that done by Jack Kirby?
I believe so.
So that traces, you know, back to the comic book superhero fantasy connection.
Kind of that sun sword and all that other stuff. Yeah. So.
And Kirby also did, what was it, Kamandi, the last child on Earth or whatever it was called. Like a post-apocalyptic story about this kid who rode around on a tiger. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, something along those lines. So anyway, we kind of I feel like, you know, we're all sort of on the same wavelength here. Mm-hmm. Like the reader mail very much lines up with the notes that I put together. But I would like to talk about a few, you know, kind of we sort of set down the basis, you know, Conan and muscular dudes and so on and so forth, melee games. But through the course of the late 80s, this style, this type sort of evolved from being brawlers and melee games, although that kind of became its own thing, like – you know, the Double Dragon through line to Streets of Rage and Final Fight. But you started to see more of this kind of semi-realistic style, like big guys with big muscles, take on more of a shooter approach. Mm-hmm. And I really feel the inflection point for that was Contra. But I'm curious to hear what you guys have to say. Like, do you feel like those games could be considered an offshoot of what we've seen here? Like, do you think they trace the same lineage and influences?
I mean, I think so. I mean, it's still oily, muscular dudes killing people, but instead of swords, it's guns. And instead of the Stone Age or Bronze Age, it's modern times or whenever they're happening. And yeah, for sure. And actually, it was odd for me to learn later in life that Rambo, the first movie, is a fairly serious movie about the plight of Vietnam veterans.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, what the heck? I was just used to Rambo being this the thing parodied in UHF, the guy who's just blowing up everything with machine guns and rocket launchers in a helicopter. I had no idea. It came from semi-serious roots.
Yeah, right around 1985, Hollywood also had a really big change in kind of the style. Like if you look at First Blood, if you look at the original Alien, those movies are very, very different from their sequels, which landed around the same time. Rambo First Blood Part 2 and Aliens, they're much bigger, more superheroic movies.
I would say the same thing for Rocky as well.
Yeah?
Yeah, for sure. It was like literally countries were fighting each other, represented by boxers.
Yeah, by the time you got to Rocky 4, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing is what you saw was just weapons started getting bigger, right? You know, you talk about the difference between Alien and Aliens, right? Aliens, they start doing – they have like the remote pods. Everybody's guns are bigger, and
they didn't have guns in Alien.
Yeah,
they had a flamethrower.
Had
a makeshift flamethrower that they put together.
Right.
But the deadliest weapon in Alien is actually a magazine. It's a rolled up magazine that they beat Ash the robot with.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going to say this could be just me being naive, but it could be that like war was so far behind us, like a war we were involved with. There was kind of like a fantasy, like, oh, wasn't war fun? Like, remember war with guns and tanks and, you know, shooting things? That was kind of interesting. And there was not the connotation like, no, we're in a war now and people are dying. This is insensitive. It was sort of like a fantasy at that time in America.
I mean, I keep thinking back to my childhood and how much like semi-automatic weapons, so you're just like permeating like everything. Like, remember EnterTech? They did those like squirt guns that look like
just like Uzis. Weapons.
Yeah,
Uzis
were the Uzi was the big like thing.
Uzi
right?
toys.
Yeah, and you just in the context of video games, there was you started getting like weapon upgrades, right? Where like heavy, it kind of culminated in like Heavy Barrel, which is like Ikari Wars, except you're collecting pieces of this ultimate weapon. And then when you get it, you're just able to wipe out just waves and waves of enemies, right? Yeah, and then the movie style, you're seeing, you know, Predator with, you know, Jesse Ventura's old painless gun, the basically like a, you know, Gatling gun.
So. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but I think the psychic scar that the Vietnam War and our terrible results there inflicted on the American psyche, I think, you know, those really made the idea of war and militarism extremely unpopular throughout the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
And it wasn't until, you know, Morning in America and the rise of Reaganism that started to become popular again, and you had stuff like G.I. Joe started as a military toy in the 60s, and in the 70s it became the adventure team. It was a guy with a beard and a turtleneck going on adventures and discovering Bigfoot. And then in 1982, they relaunched it again as G.I. Joe, the American military Delta Force, fighting a terrorist organization. And they had realistic jets and machine guns and tanks.
And I think in the 80s, we'd all see this fantasy of actually fighting Russia. Like,
right.
We want to fight them. We want to shoot Russian people. We want to Red Dawn, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, what if Russia invaded us? Oh, my God. Like, there was this thirst for war or conflict in a way that was very very naive, you know, I think, in that time.
And it's really interesting how this shaped – like this aspect of a very – like totally American culture shaped Japanese games.
Right.
Because in Japan, I just had a conversation with a couple of former Capcom composers and you know, just kind of incidentally, because my wife is Vietnamese, it came up in conversation like about how she left Vietnam literally at the very last second at the end of the war as an infant in her parents' lap. And the Japanese composers were like, oh yeah, you know, that's something that we don't really know anything about. Like that wasn't our war. So we only know that there was a war. We don't know the details of it. We don't know the process. And it, you know, like even so, because war became so unpopular here, I think that did account a lot for the rise of fantasy, you know, Lord of the Rings and Conan and that sort of thing, and sci-fi, Star Wars.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the 80s,
giving
militarism started, like, you know, after a decade, that started to come into vogue again. And, you know, the sort of go America, let's take on the Russians and win the Cold War became popular again. And so you started to see more militarism in movies. And then you started to see it in games with stuff like Contra and Metal Gear.
Russian attack.
Russia. So yeah, like it's – the more I think about this, the more interesting it is.
So it's not a crackpot theory. Thank God.
I don't think it is.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at the kinds of game themes you saw in the early 80s, there was very little. Like you very rarely saw combat for Atari 2600. That was the exception rather than the rule. But in the late 80s, it was much more like – you know, Heavy Barrel, what's the name of Guevara in the U.S.?
Guerrilla War.
Yeah, Guerrilla War.
I mean, like, I think like every war film now is a sobering look, like a Saving Private Ryan look at the horrors of war, like Hacksaw Ridge and stuff like that.
I saw that last night.
There's no like fun romps with machine guns and, you know, fun explosions anymore.
Right.
Now that, because we've been in a war for 15 years, I guess.
Yeah.
14 years. Yeah. So I feel like, we were a little naive and a little comfortable in the 80s.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at action movies now, right, or like ones with gunplay, it's sort of like the lone guy versus his localized sort of problem.
John Wick.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of the platonic ideal right now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Rather than like us versus country.
Yeah. But you do still see a lot of military type games. But even those seem to have a lot of uncertainty about what they do, what they're about. Call of Duty 4 is 10 years old now. We could do a Retronauts on it. And that game, you know, even though it is very like, you're cool, you're killing stuff, there are endless waves of soldiers, it also did make an attempt to show kind of the ugly side of war.
I believe, I mean, spoilers, but the first thing that happens is that you're executed in the beginning of the game. Yeah. So,
and it's not just American soldiers running around. It's a coalition of international allies contributing to the fight.
And eventually, Kevin Spacey would take over for whatever reason.
Yeah. So, the video games have kind of wrestled a lot with the idea of war, but I think that's kind of a different topic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, going back to stuff like Contra, I feel like that really sort of set the tone for basically an entire sort of universe of platform shooter games. I mean, mm-hmm. you also had stuff like Mega Man that came out around the same time as Contra. Was another one? I mean, Ghosts and Goblins was technically a platform shooter, even though, you know, you're throwing lances or daggers or crosses or whatever. Still, functionally, it's identical.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you do start to see more of this. Rolling Thunder is another one, 1986 or so. Shinobi, where there's both melee and ranged attacks. You start to see this sort of variant offshoot where the manly guys are not necessarily killing guys with their fists. They're killing guys, but they're okay with doing it from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Russian Attack earlier, and that one's interesting because it is a melee action game.
It's a knife game.
Where you do get weapons, but they're extremely scarce and extremely powerful, and you really have to conserve your ammunition. So that, to me, that's almost like the sort of bridge between Kung Fu and Contra, like a game where you're still a guy with a bladed weapon, with a sharp weapon, a sharp stick, but there's guns out there and they're very helpful. So why don't we just move entirely to using guns and look how powerful we can be then?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, this also goes to you're able to have a lot more on the screen, right? So with Contra, you can have just projectiles coming at you from everywhere. And so you saw like bullet hell shooters mm-hmm. and things like that starting. So yeah, well, you might as well have something you could fire back.
Yeah, technology and constraints and new possibilities were mm-hmm. very, very important to all of this. I mean, Metal Gear has been mentioned a few times, and that was a game defined by the limitations of its platform. It's, you know, one screen at a time, and it's a stealth game because it was on the MSX home computer, not the MSX2, but the MSX1, which was early 80s technology and didn't have the ability to create a game like Capcom's Commando where it's tons of enemies swarming you and shooting at you. They had to kind of limit it to, you know, there can be like three enemies on the screen, and it's really mm-hmm. best to avoid them. So that way it's never really pushing the hardware too hard. Bob, you mentioned
Fist of the North Star.
Fist of the North Star. Yeah. We should also talk about the manga influence. Manga and anime in a lot of ways were influenced by Western media, but by far it's much more of a very specific Japanese medium, I think, and speaks to different cultural sensibilities than Rambo or whatever. So it's you know, a lot of that's reabsorbing media from other countries and processing it and spitting out something that is distinct and unique to a culture.
So, no, I agree. I really feel like it really all goes back to the Warriors in some way. I don't know if we've talked about that, but just so much of the urban blight with people in punk outfits that I see. Even in like Fist of the North Star, I think it's like a mix of that and Mad Max. Mm-hmm. But and there's a lot of influences that go into this adult male manga. I'm not sure if Golgo 13 is that buff, but it's definitely part of that. Take no shit, super violent, masculine manga.
Yeah, Golgo 13 is interesting because he is actually very buff. Like sometimes in the comics, you see him and he shirtless or whatever. And he's really muscular, and as the series has gone on, he's become more and more scarred.
Mm.
So he's like aged, even though he hasn't aged, you know, in terms of looking older. The sort of wear has shown on his body. But you know, his primary specialty, even though he's a very capable hand-to-hand fighter, his specialty is shooting people from a very great distance.
Yeah, yeah. Sniper.
Which is actually kind of hard to, you know, turn that into an interesting video game. There have been Golgo 13 video games, and there was an arcade game a couple of years ago that was just like a sniping game.
I've seen videos. It's really cool. I think one of the missions is you have to snipe the high heel of a woman's shoe for some reason. It's just lots of really creative scenarios like that.
Precursor to Silent Scope, right? Yeah.
Well, I think Silent Scope kind of was more of a precursor to Golgo 13, or at least that particular game. Because, you know, you look at the NES game for Golgo 13, and it does have sniping sequences, but very, very few.
Yeah.
It's mostly like you're walking and shooting guys with a pistol.
Yeah.
Sometimes you miss, which Golgo 13 never does. It's
and he never
not canonical.
He never went through a lot of mazes in the manga, if I recall.
Actually, the maze part kind of reminds me of that one movie where he's like fighting a living golden statue of a Greek god.
The only movie I know is Queen Bee.
It was a different one. There is another one, and I don't know what it's called.
I was going to say, those mazes remind me of Fester's Quest, which is it's a nightmare, and we talked about that on a previous episode. So,
although the manual for Golgo 13 does have maps for all the mazes inside.
Thank
so
God.
If you didn't rent it, then it was a much easier game to get through. I did beat it back in the day. I don't know. I'm not sure where else to go with this. I was really hoping Frank would be here to talk about the guy games.
Well, we can talk about – I mean there are other Hollywood influences in your notes that I find are pretty interesting, like Bayou Billy. It was this was covered in the Simpsons episode Bart versus Australia, but the short-lived fascination America had with Australian things.
Yahoo Serious Film Festival.
Exactly. This is definitely
– Paul Hogan, Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah, this was definitely of that like 3 to 4 year period. And Bayou Billy was Paul Hogan in Crocodile Dundee, and this is the only time I can tell this this story. But I was looking, I don't know why, but I looked up the Japanese commercial for this game because Japanese commercials are usually more interesting. There's some animation or whatever, and this one is pretty cool. But in Japan, the game is called Mad City, but it is a non-English speaker saying the name of the game, so he keeps saying Mad Shitty. It's like, yes, this game is Mad Shitty. And this is the only time I can tell that story, and that's it.
Okay. you're right. But you know, even though it is very clearly influenced by Crocodile Dundee, it doesn't take place in Australia. It takes place in New Orleans.
The bayou.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So you're fighting through the swamps of New Orleans and into Bourbon Street.
Where did Crocodile Dundee take place, though? Did they go to New Orleans or was he like
– No, it started in Australia and then he went to New York City.
New York City was the second movie, right?
It was the first one too.
He was always the fish out of water.
Crocodile Dundee to Lost in New York.
The third one was like L.A. and it's like this is 2001 and we don't care anymore. Yeah.
Right. It walks on people's heads.
Please go away.
I didn't even realize there was a third one.
Yep.
But no, I feel like there's almost like some Dukes of Hazzard in Bayou Billy because the guy you fight at the end kind of looks like Boss Hogg. But you know, Double Dragon really gets on that Fist of the North Star thing, the Warriors thing.
I mean, yeah.
The enemies you fight are all named for characters from Enter the Dragon, William and Roper and so forth.
The second game is a post-apocalyptic game, which is easy to ignore because it's not really reflected in a lot of the designs. But if you read the intro text, it says it takes place after this like nuclear holocaust or whatever.
Well, the first game does too, actually.
Well, the first game does as well?
It doesn't really play it up, but it's, you know, that's why you have guys like Abobo who are just basically mutants.
I thought he had like just some kind of birth defect or something.
That's why you have the armored helicopter inside your garage.
Basically,
So I was just thinking of the first boss in Double Dragon 2 that has like the LeVar Burton headset on and he just disappears when you beat him or whatever. It just reminds me of a Mad Max-y kind of thing.
Right. Well, we kind of talked about this earlier, that the enemy design, like the sort of street toughs, right? Like the dude with the mohawk or enemies like that just were prevalent in both film and in games, right? If you look at the first Terminator, right? He runs into Bill Paxton, who's dressed as sort of like that crazy guy. He's got the paint on his face. Definitely that Warriors influence. So
it is fun to live in the Bay Area where there are still punks around, and I'll just be on the BART subway train, and they'll be surrounded by punks, and I'm thinking, I'm in a Final Fight level.
Actually, the other day I was riding downtown, and I was wearing like my usual sort of almost retro 1960s
it's your Paul F.
blazer
Tompkins cosplay
and hat and tie, And this kid sat down next to me and was totally like shaved hair, mohawk, punk with very meticulously torn jeans. I was like, man, this is such a San Francisco scene.
Yeah, punk did not die here.
Right.
Nope, absolutely not.
Like that scene.
I'm sure it was a very amusing visual contrast, the two of us.
It's just like all these games where you beat up punks in the streets, like rainbow mohawked punks. There are so many of these games from the 80s and the 90s that can go back directly to the Warriors. And I think Streets of Fire was another big 80s movie that is not not mentioned as much, but it is like basically the Streets of Rage movie. It like Final Fight can draw back to that in the Warriors Streets of Fire.
Yeah, and then you had other Hollywood influences too, like games like Rolling Thunder. It's a very different sort of masculinity. It's that sort of sleek, cool spy, like 1960s, suave, like Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah.
The guy you play as in Rolling Thunder, Albatross, is very tall and lanky. And,
does he have big hair?
He does not have big hair.
Oh, it's close cropped, right? Yeah.
Well, it's just kind of like a normal.
Yeah, I think the side art. Yeah, it's kind of got hair, but
little bit of anime there. Yeah. But yeah, like even the music, it has a very sort of 60s vibe to it, like Spy Guy, and that that's Spy Guy. That's kind of the James Bond idea of masculinity. James Bond didn't get really ripped until 2006.
No, he didn't.
With Daniel Craig. That was the movie where instead of Ursula Andress coming out of the water and making everyone horny, it was Daniel Craig coming out of the water and making everyone horny. I guess we could, you know, just name Hollywood influences if we wanted to all day. But instead, let's kind of wrap this up by bookending it with another Jordan Mechner game. Mm. We talked about Karateka as sort of a big sort of formative moment in realistic proportions and sort of naturalistic character animation and design in video games. And Jordan Mechner ended out the 90s or the 80s, kicked off the 90s with another game that really took that to the next level, which is Prince of Persia. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's an important game because it sort of dialed back the idea of like a powerful hero as just a lump of gristle. Instead, you had sort of this young teenager, kind of wiry and very athletic and nimble. And his ability wasn't so much, you know, he was a hero, but his challenge wasn't to beat everyone up and kick a lot of ass, but rather to navigate, to smartly make it through puzzles and traps. And it made action heroes more intellectual all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And that didn't necessarily, you know, become the predominant theme, but you did see a lot of games start to kind of pattern themselves after Prince of Persia. You had, you know, Flashback and Out of This World and quite a few other games along those lines where the heroes weren't, you know, super heroic. They were more natural. It was kind of like the Die Hard of video games in a way. Not in the sense of like it is a game like Die Hard, but just in the way it sort of redefined what an action hero could be.
More of an everyman.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah.
Die Hard was the end of the bodybuilder trend in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You really saw that start to go away.
Like Mario could just jump wherever he wanted, but you'd have to like pull yourself up to the tops of, precipices and things like that. Whenever I play a 2D game that has that mechanic in it, I always think of Prince of Persia, like when Metroid Fusion added it. Was it Fusion or Zero Mission? Yeah, I immediately thought, like, this is great. I'm glad they did this, but it is Prince of Persia completely. You don't have to jump, land with your feet on the ledge. You can grab onto it and then pull yourself up.
So what would you guys say is the sort of the legacy of these games, this trend? I guess, you know, I was going to say, like, after Die Hard, movies became less about the super muscular guy in Hollywood and more about like a guy barely scraping through on his own wits. And video games also kind of, they moved a little bit away from that. But I think because of the nature of video games, they never really got fully away from that.
No.
And if anything, It's hard to get away from video games that are about a guy killing everything.
Yeah, I think even as early as 1996, something like Duke Nukem 3D was a throwback to 80s movies to the point where they, oh, I like all these movies. I'm just going to steal the dialogue and put it in this character's mouth. Like, I feel like that was just like, oh, remember these movies? Weren't they cool? Wasn't it cool to have a big oily guy with a gun shooting everything in the face? Even as early as then, but I think now you can no longer present those ideas sincerely, which is why we have things or had things like Bulletstorm, where it's like we have these macho idiots and we're going to have fun with it because you're not going to take this seriously. You've right. seen these tropes before, so we're going to
so
have fun.
So these guys
with
are going to say stuff like dick tits.
Yeah, or like shit dicks or whatever. I forget what they say. But yeah, it's way over the top. But I like – you can't present these ideas seriously just because they are so tropey. They become the object of ridicule. And
I would say even Duke Nukem 3D was – you know, not taking itself seriously, was presenting the action hero as sort of a throwback. Like,
for sure,
the idea
yeah.
of, you know, this is a guy out of time.
He was very much as Schwarzenegger was in 96 becoming like the family goofball dad role in all of his movies, like Jingle All the Way. Duke Nukem was a throwback to when the hero was just a violent sociopath with a gun and very, very oily.
Well, I think the thing you're also seeing now is the games industry, or at least the genres, it's so broad now compared to what we were buying, you know, back in the 80s. So while larger releases still have that, you know, protagonist killing a bunch of people, there's a lot of guns and explosions, a lot of AAA money is sort of funneled in that direction. If you look at the number of games where you don't do that, you know, that are available is staggering compared to where it used to be. So I think we're still carrying a lot of the legacy of, you know, guys with guns, and there's always going to be guys with guns games, but because now there's a much wider range of people who play games, who create games, and most importantly can distribute, you know, this will always be a genre. It was much more important in terms of the overall percentage of games back then, but, you know, nowadays, we have a lot more choice.
Yeah. So someone like Nathan Drake is a man with a gun who murders thousands of people in cold blood. But I don't trace him back to a Schwarzenegger or a Stallone. I mean, obviously, it's sort of a Tomb Raider takeoff. But I don't see any kind of movie influences in Uncharted. I don't know if you guys do at all.
Oh, I mean, it's totally Raiders of the Lost Ark. There's a lot of like Hollywood aspiration.
I just don't see as much gunplay with Indiana Jones outside of like the few instances it happens.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, Indiana Jones was much more about wits and fists.
Yeah.
But in video games, you really got away from the idea of melee combat. I think part of that had to do with, you know, the rise of first-person shooters because melee combat does not work in that genre unless you're very, very lucky.
Unless you're
very good.
Infinity Blade, I guess.
Yeah. But, you know, I think also you kind of owe it to these shooters, like stuff like Shatterhand or Power Blade or whatever. They just moved away from melee combat, and it's very rare to see an action game that is based mainly around melee combat, or at least it was until they kind of figured out how to make it interesting again with Batman, basically, Arkham Asylum.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And then
yeah.
sort of on the Japanese side, Dark Souls and Demon Souls said, you know, what if instead of, you know, I guess there's two different philosophies at work there. In Batman, Assassin's Creed, it's the Western approach where it's like, this should be a quick, easy, breezy, sort of semi-automated approach. Mm-hmm. And Dark Souls is like, it should not be quick and easy and breezy or automated. It should be an effort of mastery. It should require you to commit yourself wholly.
It's methodical with slow animations for the most part and a lot of waiting for an opening, things like that.
I honestly, in a lot of ways, I feel like Dark Souls is descended spiritually from fighting games, which you might not think to look at the way the game appears or the genre that it's in.
Yeah.
But the idea of you know, really being conscious of your movement and your relative location to enemies and countering foes and understanding their tells, like that's very much something that kind of went away in video games for a long time, except in fighting games.
I think you're right. I think an even better example, that's a good example, but Brett Elston, former Capcom employee, has said this, our old friend Jose Otero said this, but Monster Hunter is very much like that. And in fact, that like each weapon is like a fighting game character, and everything is about like, know what every animation does, know how long it takes to play out, know where the hitboxes are. It's all about that sort of very, like all about intentionality, all about these methodical encounters that are very, it's not just button mashing. It's just about knowing your weapon and knowing your moveset.
Yeah.
And just finally, to close out, I think it's interesting that this was such a huge trend in Japanese games in the 80s and then basically completely vanished from Japanese games. It kind of became a joke in and of itself with the Choaniki series.
Yeah.
Which are like, you know, bodybuilders in space, and it's very like very deliberately over the top, pretty much laughably homoerotic.
But in the
kind of, you know, not like an appealingly homoerotic way, but more like a, haha, isn't this silly? Isn't this ridiculous kind of way?
And I really think Shinji Mikami's God Hand is very much like that. It's like a comedy Fist of the North Star almost, where you're like spanking people and things like that. But it's very, very, very mechanical in terms of the combat. Like, you choose your moveset. You unlock moves and decide what each button does. It's very, very involved.
Yeah, but these games are very much the exception to the rule.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
I think, you know, you tend to see more of that sort of beefy man style in Western games, but it doesn't feel like it comes from the Conan vibe. It feels more like it comes from, you know, 90s Image Comics vibe. Like, video game aesthetics have not gotten past Rob Liefeld.
Oh, and I'm thinking of the entire time we're doing this, I'm thinking of, and I think, I'm sure I referenced this before in Retronauts, but that infamous Rob Liefeld?
Yeah.
Liefeld?
I guess it's Liefeld.
The Captain
Liefeld.
America.
Captain America, of course. Yeah. Yes. And just like, are you kidding me? And it probably wasn't on this podcast, but there's a great video of Stan Lee just destroying him on this 90s television show. And he's just like, oh, no, you drew this wrong. Like, who's this guy? Oh, he's so dark. Like, you have to look this up. Just type in Stan Lee, Rob Liefeld on YouTube. You'll find it. I think we've come around to forgive him, but it's still a fun takedown of the Image style.
I mean, Rob Liefeld is I'm not a fan of his art style. I was when I was a kid, and I was like, that's really cool. He does everything
so weird.
Look
how many lines there are.
And not even that. That was – it was more like
– That's Todd McFarlane.
It was their inkers is what it was. But no, Rob Liefeld, I was like, wow, he just, you know, draws all these crazy details, and then other things he doesn't feel like he needs to detail at all, like feet.
Why is every character standing behind a bush?
Yeah. But I have come around a little bit. Like, I don't like his art, but I respect him for just doing him. Like, he does his thing, and he's happy to do that.
Sure.
And he's been successful at it, so God bless him.
It's not for me, but God bless you.
But, I mean, that style is so pervasive and stuff like, you know, Gears of War and Arkham Asylum. Like, I didn't play Arkham Asylum, and I should have.
God, you're
but I was so
good.
I was just so turned off by the aesthetic of it. I was like, this is the opposite of what I want from Batman. I don't want Batman to be like, you know, King Slab. I want him to be like this sinewy, shadowy creature, which is actually kind of how he plays in the game, but it's not how everything looks.
And he is King Slab in that newer movie.
By the time I
I will never see.
It's really bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, by the time I realized, oh no, actually, in terms of mechanics, this is really interesting. It was the ship had already sailed, and I never had time.
You will like it. It is a very Metroid.
Game. I've played, you know, parts of it.
Okay,
and I've played the sequels, but
first one's the best.
That's my understanding. But you know, just it is the first impression that it gave is just like, this is missing the point so badly. But it turns out it didn't.
It's funny because spoilers, I guess, whatever, who cares. The final boss is the Joker all roided out on some kind of super serum.
Yeah.
And he is totally like out of the McFarlane box of ideas. Yep. It is not good. It is
the
not
McFarlane
good.
Box.
Yeah.
So anyway, we actually need to kind of wind down now.
Yeah, we got another one to record.
So I am going to wrap it up here. But I hope this was an interesting topic. It was kind of me monologuing a lot and kind of all over the place, but I don't know. It is an interesting trend that I've been wanting to write about for a very long time. So I'm glad that I finally got to exorcise that demon, that very muscular demon. So thanks, guys, for joining us. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, everyone who wrote in. There were some great letters this time. We'll be back next week with more podcasting. But first, why don't we find out more about the people whose voices you've been hearing, Bob?
Oh, it's me. Hey, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also write every day for fandom, video game stuff, sometimes anime if you're lucky, at fandom.com. And I'm also on Something Awful. I've been writing there for like 12 years now, every other Thursday for that long. A new comedy article every other Thursday at somethingawful.com. And my other podcast is Talking Simpsons. It's a chronological exploration of The Simpsons every Wednesday at TalkingSimpsons.com. We go into super great detail on every episode. By the time you hear this, we should be midway into season 5, so you literally have 100 episodes to listen to. Just choose one of an episode you like, and you should like the show. I almost guarantee it.
Wow.
Steve?
Steve Lin, Stephen P. Lin on Twitter, and I'm on the board of the Video Game History Foundation. We just launched on Monday, so you can find out more about us at gamehistory.org.
And finally, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, and you can find me at Retronauts, because that's what I'm doing. I'm making Retronauts. You can, of course, support the podcast by going to patreon.com/retronauts. Your donations, your contributions keep us going. If you contribute $3 a month, you get an advance episode a week ahead of everyone else, plus without any advertisements, so that's nice. And even if you don't support us, that's fine. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us at retronauts.com. Hopefully by the time this episode airs, the site will have launched properly and we'll have amazing content for you every single day. That's very, very cool. I know because I'm working on it and it's going to be cool. So I think that's everything, all the housekeeping we need to do. So thanks again for listening and we'll be back in a week or maybe sooner than that if there's a micro before. Who knows? It's going to be awesome. We always do stuff. So much stuff. Thanks.